Hi, it's Liz Dunchy, editor of thecorporatecouncil.net. Welcome to our podcast. I'm here today with two very accomplished women. First, we have Tara Dunn, who is a member of our community and a regular participant at our Women's 100 conference. She's currently running the Highmark Law Firm in Denver after being deputy GC at a public IT services company and practicing at Hogan Lovells and Morrison Foerster. And Tara connected Brock and me with our other guest today, Dr. Stephanie Johnson, who is an associate professor of management at the University of Colorado Boulder's Leeds School of Business, studying leadership and diversity, including the impact of unconscious bias, which is what we'll be talking about today. So thank you both for agreeing to do this podcast, and I'll turn it over to Tara to tell us more about how she met Steph and why she wanted to introduce her to the rest of our community.
Hey, Liz, thanks for having us today, and thanks for that great introduction. So I first met Steph at a symposium in Denver a few months ago on increasing women's presence on corporate boards. And Stephanie was the keynote speaker, and she opened by discussing her research on how unconscious bias impacts director recruiting. And it was just so relevant to me and my practice, and obviously to our community, given all the attention that our public company clients are getting around board diversity from shareholders, proxy advisors, and institutional investors. And I'm also kind of just a junkie for all things board and all things about inclusion. So I, of course, chased Stephanie down and went up to Boulder as soon as her classes were over and bothered her to meet me for coffee. And we just talked about her research and my experiences. And it just seemed like there was such a good intersection. I thought she'd be a great resource for our practice community.
Thank you. That's such a nice introduction.
I agree with that. So we're very happy that you made this introduction. And thanks, Steph, again, for being here today. Can you tell us all a little bit more about what Tara heard and how unconscious bias impacts the director search process?
Yeah, definitely. So what I talked about there is just the basic idea that we all have mental models or prototypes for what leaders look like, what board members look like, what basketball players look like, all of these things, and it's really hard for us to see around those mental models to select someone who's different. And so when you think of leaders, of a Fortune 500 CEO, we know 95 or 96% of them are men. And so when you're trying to decide who to select into that role, you automatically consider other men because they're just seen as like they fit the job better. They seem ready for the job. You're not sure why, you just get like a good feeling about them. But because women are so scarce on boards and in top leadership roles, you don't think of women. And so when you do, if a woman's up for consideration, you tend to stereotype them in really extreme ways. So, you know, women will be less competent, less experienced, too young, right? Like, she doesn't have C-suite experience, whereas a man without C-suite experience still seems like a better fit for the role, but just because he has the man thing going for him. And so there was a study that showed, and it wasn't mine, but I wish it were, that for first-time board directors, the women have to have significantly more experience than first-time male board directors. And so why I think that's super interesting is when you ask corporations why they don't have more women on their board, they always say, because there's not enough women with experience. And I'm like, that's right, because you give them a higher bar of experience. Right. If you just create an equal playing field, there actually are a ton of women. And that's what I was talking about to the women in the room. There's like, I mean, in Colorado, I think we're one of the worst states in terms of women on boards, but there was a room filled with hundreds of board ready women.
I think that was what was just shocking. Yeah,
and the scary part, too, is the part that makes it more of a problem, I guess, is the unconscious part. People don't realize that they're doing that. And so, like you were saying, they just think to themselves, oh, she's not quite board ready, when in fact, if they were mindful of that being a potential issue, then they could step back and actually take a look at the data in front of them and realize that the resumes are the same or the woman might even be more qualified.
Yeah, for sure.
We've seen some companies start to implement so-called Rooney rules to make sure that there are diverse candidates in their board recruiting pools. And do you think that taking steps like that will help take care of this problem?
I do. So the Rooney rule, as it was originally written, and I only learned this recently because I don't ever watch football, but is that you have to interview at least one African-American potential coach mm-hmm. for every open coaching position in the NFL. And a lot of organizations implement exactly that, right? You have to interview one diverse candidate. And so it's funny that you wanted to talk about that, because one of my research studies basically showed the Rooney rule doesn't work. So I went back and analyzed NFL data, and I analyzed data from job searches, and then we did experiments that we manipulated the candidates and little pictures and stuff. But when you put one, they're still never selected. And I think it comes down to when you have one woman and three men or four men or two men, and you're raising men are the norm, that one woman appears to be there because, you know, you wanted to put a woman on the slate, or you don't really consider her as qualified. You consider her as like, do we want to hire a woman? And I think it's the same in the NFL. You think of, you know, do we want to have an African-American coach? And if so, we'll consider that person. And if not, we won't, because they can only be there because they were placed there based on the Rooney rule. But what we found was pretty cool, that if you just put two candidates, diverse candidates, women or ethnic minorities, or even one woman and one ethnic minority, but the result was a lot weaker, that in fact it dramatically increased the chances of hiring a woman. Because if there's two, you don't get the feeling that they're there just because they're a woman, and you still have to compare them to each other. So which is the better woman? And then you're comparing the men to each other and the women to each other. And in doing that, you've actually thought about them a little bit more deeply. And maybe then you have that realization that the women are more qualified or equally qualified as the male applicants. Right? So I think, yes, I think the Rooney rule is fantastic. It's just making people work a little harder or think a little more deeply about where they're getting their candidates from, because most board searches, you get your candidates from your existing networks, people you served on previous boards with, or people you know through business. And we know that our networks tend to be strikingly similar to us in right. terms of our ethnic and gender background. And, or they use executive search firms, and executive search firms are, you know, they're using the same process, right? They're not necessarily putting, unless they are an executive search firm that specializes in women and ethnic minorities, they're not necessarily digging really deep to find people. But when you have those rules, it makes you do it.
Yes, although one firm, Heidrick & Struggles, I think it is, announced a few months ago that beginning this year, they're going to include, I think it's 50% women. I can't remember if it's women or diverse candidates or how exactly it's yeah. defined, but 50% of the candidates who they suggest to boards will be diverse. So hopefully that, and they're sort of a mainstream executive
yeah,
search
that's
firm.
Amazing.
So, yeah. So hopefully that will set an example for other firms and make it so that even if companies haven't formally adopted some sort of Rooney rule, they're still seeing a pretty broad group of candidates when they're recruiting.
Yeah, I love that.
Hey, can I jump in and ask a question just because I think it kind of,
yeah, of course.
Is a good segue? Yeah. Steph, I love it, the examples. You gave some really relevant examples when we were at the symposium. And I think it was really shocking to me because I get what implicit bias is or unconscious bias, but you gave some statistics around like CEOs named David or John, and you also have talked before, and I can't remember if it was at the symposium or after I was a binge watcher on YouTube and found one of your talks, but you also talk about unconscious bias where you give examples. You know, you give the rock, the alcohol at the party example, or I think the NBA example is really interesting in terms of how people perceive who's good at what. Would you mind kind of just talking us through that a little bit? Because I think I think it's really important context for this group.
Yeah, so I love that you asked that because, you know, I talk about unconscious bias a lot, and I was at a talk really recently, and I used the MBA example, which I'll share in a second here. And a man came up to me at the end of the presentation, and he's like, you know, kind of executive level, older white guy. And he said, you know, I've been to so many of these things on unconscious bias, but when you explained it in terms of basketball, it finally made sense. And I was like, oh, that's it. We just need sports analogies. That's what's been holding us back all these years. Once you put it in the context of sports, it just makes so much sense. So I just give the example of, I tell people to think of a basketball player, and everyone can probably think of one. Even me, who I don't watch a lot of sports, I can think of a basketball player. And then I ask people who they think of. Did you guys think of a basketball player?
Yep.
Steph Curry.
Who that's who I thought of too.
Steph Curry. Yes. That's actually who I think of. Michael Jordan, Steph Curry. But everyone thinks of an African-American male basketball player. You know, African-American men do comprise a large majority of the NBA, but not everyone. You know, maybe it's 82%. But what's important about that is when you think about, yes, you think of an African-American male, but I ask people, on some level, do you believe that African-American men are better basketball players than white guys or white women, right? And everyone, well, mostly everyone says, yeah, they are, right? Because if you look at the proportion of the population that's African-American men, and then the proportion that are NBA players, they must, like, it's out of sync. Like, they must, African-American men must be better basketball players, or they wouldn't be so overrepresented in the NBA, because African-American men do not comprise 82% of the U.S. population, right? And, you know, people have no trouble agreeing with this. It makes a lot of sense. And then I liken that to CEOs. So white men are 31% of the U.S. population, and they're 90% of CEOs. And so when you think of a CEO, you think of a white man, but on some level, you also believe that white men must be better CEOs because they are vastly overrepresented in that role, and your brain just does the math. It puts the logic together. And for that one, everyone says, no, I don't think that. I mean, it's privilege, it's historical differences. And but you're, I mean, even if you don't admit it, I think your brain is doing that same logic. And so that's kind of the underlying cause of the preference, the slight preference for a white man. Like, you just, it just makes more sense, right? Like, they just fit. And if you even think of basketball player, like, I remember there was Yao Ming as a Asian basketball player in the NBA. And just, you know, what a huge stir that caused. Mm-hmm. And, like, he became the, you know, he's the outlier and also has to then represent all Asian basketball players. And so if he does well, you know, that says something. If he doesn't, then that's something else. And I think that's another parallel that we see when it comes to leadership and board membership, that if you do end up with a female board member or a female CEO and they're not successful, then it just reinforces the idea that women aren't successful. Whereas if you think about the number of men who aren't successful, it's like, it's many, many more, but because the women examples are so much more visible and rare, it's like, you know, we knew Marissa Myers was going to tank Yahoo, right? Like,
well, not only that, but I've read, and I'm sure you are much more well-researched in this than I am, but I've read some studies saying that women are more likely to accept roles at companies that are maybe going downhill anyway, because it's so difficult to get a directorship as a woman. And so, if anything comes your way, you may not be as choosy as a man in a similar position would be. And so a woman ends up taking a directorship at a company that's heading towards bankruptcy and is sort of, or a CEO position, and is expected to turn the company around and right the ship. But the momentum is already so far down the track that it doesn't work. And so then they kind of get blamed for it too.
Right, exactly. And then it's not the company's fault, right? They hired this woman, but they call that the glass cliff.
Yes.
So rather than the glass ceiling, like, we're going to let you through, but you're going to slip. And I think a lot of
then we're going to blow really hard and you're going to fall off the edge.
Exactly. Mary Vera as being like the perfect example of that. She took over GM, and it's like this company was, you know, under congressional investigation and all these other things, but she did do the impossible and turn the company around, which is good.
Yeah, and then she's exceptional, and that's just a one-off example, and no other woman can do that.
That's right. She's the only one. And Steph, on the basketball, I'm so fascinated with the basketball because I do think people get it when you talk about it. What's so crazy is what percentage of the NBA African-American males are now versus, what, the 50s, and you had a funny picture, which, of course, we can't see, but was the Lakers?
Yeah, it was the 1953 Minneapolis Lakers, and they're all white guys. And it shows that all of these stereotypes are not, they're not inherent, you know. They're just learned. It's like what we see in the environment. And so in the 1950s, did anyone think that African-American men were better basketball players? Did anyone think of an African-American man when you thought of a basketball player? No, because, in fact, African-American men weren't even allowed to play in the NBA. And so you couldn't have that stereotype. And I think, to me, why that's a good thing is it means that we can change the stereotypes. We can change the image of who you think of when you think of a CEO or a board director if we can start getting women into those roles. You know, these things are changeable. And I think we can do that. That's why I like things like the Rooney Rule. Maybe, you know, people get mad, like it's too tough of an intervention. But I think you have to get the ball rolling. And we look at the board data over, you know, since the 90s, it is not changing. And in the 90s, people said, it's only a matter of time. Now, as more women, you know, entered universities and entered the workforce in the 1970s, 1980s, there are going to be more women CEOs and board directors. And they said that again in the 2000s. And now it's 2019. And the numbers are not changing, even though the excuse of fewer women in the workplace doesn't work because women comprise more than half of the workforce. And in terms of education, you know, women are actually significantly more well-educated, represent more of a greater percentage of college students. So it's not changing. And it's just because of the self-reinforcing nature. As long as it stays the same and that stays our prototype, then the women are still going to be excluded. So I like the big, you know, let's do something different. Some of the work that's been done in Europe, and I think even California, which is something that we were chatting about and how that's going to change things, requiring boards to have, what is it, two women for companies that are located in California?
It's one by the end of 2019 for public companies that are headquartered in California. And I want to say, I don't have it in front of me, but I want to say it's three by the end of 2021 for boards that have more than so many directors, five or six. But it might be two. I just can't remember off the top of my head. But it's definitely more than one, which is encouraging.
Yeah, and so important because there was a great research study, and I wish I could tell you the author, but that found that the benefit of women on boards was greatest when you had three women. And so I like the fact that they're taking that, they're striving. That's just like one, you're a token, you know, like no one listens to you. You're still like in the corner, not at the table. Two, it's like twice as many. But three, it's like now that it feels somewhat balanced, I guess. Usually a board has about 10 members. If 30% of them are women, I think that changes it. I like it then.
Well, as you can imagine, that law is getting some pushback from people and there's some consternation over what this will do to board composition as far as qualifications and skills. So what would you say to companies who worry about restricting their options for the board candidates and possibly that not being in the best interest of shareholders?
If anyone believed that, they clearly haven't read the data because study after study show that companies that have more women on the board perform better. They have higher return on assets. They have higher stock prices. They're less likely to have to restate their earnings, meaning like they lie less. That's good. And so having more women on the board should actually improve those outcomes. And as far as limiting, that's like to me the big irony when people talk about, you know, I want to get the best person for the job. Like, I don't want to be restricted. But if we're okay. all using our personal networks to hire people, are we really getting the best person for the job? Like, I don't know that many people. So do I believe that the best person for the job really lies in my tiny network? That's just absurd, right? But I would actually imagine that you're getting a greater pool of applicants because you're going outside your network and finding talent that you didn't even know about.
Yeah, that's a good way to look at it. Tara, do you have any insight into that from your previous role as a deputy GC?
You know, it's a great question, and I was thinking about this. You know, so Steph just made the business case for the value of diverse boards. So that's my first point, isn't better company performance in the best interest of the shareholders? So first and foremost, read the research. But, you know, this is a conversation that I've been having more and more with boards over the past few years. And, you know, my thoughts on narrowing, I think, are similar to Steph's, but I ask boards, is it looking to increase women and minority candidates on your board the opposite of narrowing? Because really, you're expanding the options of candidates that you'll look at. And public companies, as Stephanie kind of referenced, often start with the existing directors' networks when they're recruiting for new board members. And since we have a pretty good understanding of who most public company board members are, it means that these are mostly the networks of older white men. So if you increase your candidate pool by 50% or 100%, you know, my argument is, aren't you actually expanding the number of candidates that could potentially increase your shareholder value?
And are they receptive to that argument?
You know, it's so company specific, right?
Yeah.
A lot of it depends on the culture. It depends on the CEO, how comfortable the CEO is, how supported the CEO feels by the board. One of my clients is a public company in Colorado that has actually had, and I haven't looked at their numbers lately. I worked with them quite a bit 2 years ago, but they had 50% women on their board.
Wow.
And they had a woman CEO, and their non-gov committee was all women.
Wow.
And it was like so amazing because you would sit there and listen to them talk about board skills and evaluating skills and, what are the gaps and where do we want to fill in and where are we going to get candidates from? And it was a very different conversation than the all-male non-gov committee that I sit in on and hear talk about this stuff. So I think it really depends on the culture and kind of the openness.
Yeah.
And I really think a lot of it, I think the unconscious bias thing, this is part of why I just was so excited to help put this together. I don't think companies, when they're recruiting executive management, and this is not all companies, obviously, or when they're recruiting for their boards, I don't think people fully get the statistics, and I also don't think that they really understand how strong the bias is.
Yeah. I know at the firm that I used to practice at, we had regular diversity and inclusion training, and one of those trainings was for everybody to take the Harvard implicit bias test. And then we had a professional facilitator come in and talk about the results. And we broke out into small teams, small groups and everything. And it was really fascinating. And I remember being sort of on fire afterwards about, like, well, exactly what you were both explaining earlier, like things that you just don't recognize until they're pointed out to you. And so I don't know if more training is the answer or what. Maybe both of you have other ideas for practical ways that boards and executives could kind of wrap their minds around that and be more cognizant of the issue.
Everybody has to be Stephanie. That's
what happens. Yeah, definitely. But, you know, I think what part of the problem that I see, and I did this study where I interviewed the head of boards of Fortune 500 companies that have at least 40% or 30% or 50% women on their boards. Okay. So these are the champions of board diversity. And I think what really struck me in talking to these folks is part of the problem is when we talk about diversity and wanting to increase diversity on the board, I feel like there's an inherent accusation
Yes.
That you, not me, like you are racist and sexist and a bad person.
Yeah, there's a lot of shame felt.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so when you say you're going to have to use the Rooney Rule, it's like, because we think you suck, right?
Yeah.
You are so sexist that we're going to put a law in place to force you to do this. And I think when people tell me I suck, I get really defensive. And I think about all the reasons why that person's an idiot and why I'm awesome, and then I'm not listening to them anymore. And I think if we could all just recognize that it's not that you suck. I mean, I have the same unconscious bias. Like, I also think of a white man when I think of a CEO. Isn't that insane? You know, like, I don't think I'm a bad person. It's just that that is the majority of CEOs, and my brain is, I have only so much capacity, and that's just, it's not malicious. It's just human nature.
Right.
And that doesn't mean that we just say, like, oh, it's human nature. I'm just allowed to do it. Who cares? It's that it's human nature. You're not a bad person and you can do better.
Yeah. You notice it and you take steps to correct
it.
And, you know, as we're talking about this, I'm kind of struck too about the point that you both were making earlier about how this is really an expansion of the candidate pool, and it should improve companies because a person's individual network or a board's individual network is so much more limited than if you're pulling in these other resources with broader and more diverse candidates. And it's kind of like, if you think about, and maybe this is a super basic point that I'm making, but it's kind of like if you think about the life cycle of a company, and before a company goes public, they're expected to bring on more independent directors. And to do that, they often have to reach outside of their individual networks. And that can be a tough conversation to have. And there can be a lot of pushback. And again, maybe it's because of implicit bias, or maybe it's just because people's feelings get hurt. But people are reluctant to give up their board seats, and they're reluctant to bring in new people who haven't been intimately familiar with the company like they have. And so that's a growing point. And maybe this is another growing point for companies where they're kind of stepping beyond what they're used to and going out of their comfort zone. And then, but it's something that they need to do to kind of reach the next level.
You know, yeah, I think that's such a good point. I really like the way you put that. But I think what's different about that, and I've never heard that analogy, but when you think about, you know, your company's going public, you need different board members, people who are not, you know, they're external. You don't think you're a bad person for that, right? So that's
right.
Why you just do it.
Right.
It's just the rule. It's like, yes, it's in the shareholder interest. This is governance. Like, it makes sense. It's fine. We follow the rules. But I think it's just because there's no, like, it's not threatening to your identity.
Yes, right.
That you have to do that.
Yeah, it's not tied to their identity, but it can still be really sensitive, and it still is because of rules that we're actually, you know, not that old. Many of them were put in place after Enron collapsed, and so I don't know. That's just something to think about, I guess. Tara, do you have any other practical ideas, or Steph, if you have any other ideas of things that boards can do to address this?
So, I will tell you my thought here. I'm hoping, Steph, if we have time, that you could talk a little bit about the ABCs, your tips, because I think that's super helpful too. But I'll give the practical application little response here. So what I've been telling companies for addressing this is to take advantage of all the work that they're already doing, because our clients have done so much work around their board skills matrix.
Yes,
right?
Yes.
So I tell companies to get really, really objective about the matrix. And what I mean is that there are, you know, tens or hundreds of thousands of highly qualified directors on public company boards today. But when you ask directors about their skills and experience for the matrix, you get responses that reflect how really, really qualified these folks are. And I know we have all seen this, right? It is so touchy. I'm sure, Liz, you know what I'm saying,
yeah.
Right? Everybody goes, yep.
I have all of those skills.
Exactly. So what I tell companies is to just be super intentional about making this matrix that you already have so much time into work for you. And so find ways to use the matrix in a more objective way. Like you could involve a third party in the ranking and scoring process, or you could have directors anonymously rank the other directors on skills and experiences. Because I think where you come out is that even if, say, two-thirds or more of your directors self-identify with a certain skill or experience, that would be true, but at varying degrees of depth. Mm-hmm. So if you can get really clear on, like, which areas you have super deep director strengths, and then maybe somewhere you have a little bit less depth on the bench, you can probably find places that a new, potentially diverse candidate could fill a real gap that you might not have already identified. And then I guess my other piece to follow on with that, and Steph alluded to this and you did as well, you know, every company, one of the skills or experiences on every matrix is CEO or C-suite experience, right? Mm-hmm. And then one of the other ones on everybody's matrix is public company board experience. And so Dr. Johnson just has really illustrated this, you know, with her research and her findings. But if those two things are prerequisites, you are not going to get very many women or minority candidates with that experience, because that's just not our landscape. So I think you have to look at the matrix and say, okay, those are things, but not everybody has to have them. They're not prerequisites. And then if you don't have that sort of bar for absolutely every category, I think you can really score a super talented director that would pick up in an area that, you know, you think you have 9 of 12 have it, but how much do they have it?
Yeah.
So that would be my advice, is, you know, take what you already do and make it more useful.
Yeah, I like that. What are the ABCs?
Okay, so the ABCs, and I have to tell you, I have DES now, but I haven't practiced them. That's as far as I'm going. I can't get any more letters. So the ABCs.
Okay, I'll call you after.
When it comes to unconscious bias, to follow these steps. Okay, so the first, the A, is admit it. I'm just, you know, as I was saying earlier, we all have them. You're not a bad person. And when you're trying not to admit it, so you're trying to, like, suppress these thoughts, like, you know, I'm not going to talk about race, I'm colorblind, I'm not going to talk about gender, I'm not a sexist. There's these cool studies in social psychology that show this ironic thought suppression effect, that you actually become more biased because you're trying not to think about it, and so you do it more. So,
oh, like if someone tells you not to think about the elephant, then you're going to be thinking about the elephant.
The white bear, the example of like, I use the example because it's so visceral to me. When I see someone has, like, something in their teeth, and I'm not going to tell them, but all I do is stare at the thing in their teeth because I'm trying not to look at it.
Yeah.
And it's like, if I just told them you have something in your teeth, then it would just go away, right? And then I could pay attention to what they're saying rather than trying to look at the food in their teeth.
Right.
So that's the A, just admit it. The B is blind it. And I've heard a lot of, so blinding is removing the gender identity or racial identity of people's resumes. So you can't tell, you're blind, right? Kind of like the National Symphony Orchestra did when they put a curtain down for people to audition. And they found, you know, vastly increased the number of women in the National Symphony from 5% to 30% because you couldn't see they were a woman. But to me, it was so powerful. Yes, you could do this in staffing and selection and board selection, but most, I would say, like, if you're choosing board members, you're really not going to blindly choose a board member, like, in your break, right? But you could do it early on, like, use your skills matrix, look at the skills of people who are, you know, potential board candidates with the names removed, and who would you select, okay? And then look at who you normally select. And what I found from a lot of organizations or companies that do this, they get this list that when they're just using skills alone, that say it's 50% women or 40% women or 30% minorities. And then they have the realization, like, whoa, if I were actually selecting on skills, I would end up with a diverse slate without you having to force me to do it. And it gives you, because you experience it for yourself, it's more meaningful than someone saying, you know, you're sexist. right? Like you see it in front of you. So blind it is the B, count it is the C. And that is no matter if you're doing any kind of diversity initiative or inclusion or hiring or board directorship, if you're not measuring your progress and setting goals and looking at ways to meet your goals, you're never going to get any movement. Like we know, like anyone who's worked in a company knows this, anything that's important to the company, you put metrics on it because you want to be able to come up with plans to meet those goals. But for diversity, people are super sketched out by measuring it.
Yeah.
It's like, it feels like quotas or some, you know, people don't like quotas. So
no, nobody likes the Q word.
Yeah. So you just don't measure it. And that's insane, right? Like, would you not measure sales performance in a new market? Like, of course you would. And why not measure even the effectiveness of the diversity initiatives that you're implementing rather than just like crossing your fingers?
I think it goes back to why people are so uncomfortable with that, because they don't want to admit that it's even an issue. And so, so they're reluctant to put any parameters around it because
the B is the same thing. If you could just do the A, you wouldn't really need the B. If we could all just admit it. And then the S, because the ABCs. So just support it. And really like truly supporting diversity and like saying it out loud, admitting it, being transparent. So it was interesting, like a lot of the board, the chairman is what I'm looking for, chairman of the boards that I talked to, really wanted to say, we have a lot of women, but we weren't trying to get women. It was just like, it just happened, right? Because, so they're supporting, they did support diversity. They ended up with this diverse board, but they don't want to publicly say, like, I support diversity. And I guess I don't really know why not, right? Like, if you do support it, like, just support it visibly and do things that you would do for anything else you support. I think some of the strongest leaders in this area that are just very vocal about their support for diversity have actually had the greatest outcomes. So I think of people like Mark Benioff at Salesforce, who's, you know, he's like a huge media personality. Like he's out, you see him all the time, and he tweets about his support for all diversity. It's not just women, it's not minorities, it's also people with disabilities, LGBTQ, international. And so I think he's publicly and visibly supporting it. And I think if more leaders did that, it would make it okay to support diversity. I think in kind of the same way that the president has made it okay to like kind of be racist and sexist for certain people. They feel licensed to just go ahead and put it out there because the president does. I think when we see more role models of people who are supporting diversity, it makes it okay.
Yeah.
To say, like, yeah, I'm on board.
Yeah. Yeah. That makes sense. And those are probably things that we can all adopt in our everyday professional and personal lives too.
Yeah, I think so.
You know, I think I love the ABCs, and it just made me think about, I'm on immediate past board chair of a big civic board in Denver called the Denver Metro Chamber Leadership Foundation. And our board, when I joined it 7 years ago, was really not diverse. If you saw the pictures, you would not, I mean, have done such a great job, but it's because we talk about it. And I think, people are so, it's scary to talk about it, and you have to be vulnerable. And when I talked about it as board chair, I always was like, am I saying it right? Like, is this going to offend somebody? Is this an okay way to refer to this? And I just think to be, you know, the admitting and supporting piece of your ABC tips, that just normalizing that it's okay to talk about it and it's okay to value it, and then it's okay to count it.
Yeah, and I feel like, you know, groups like yours and like doing things like this podcast, I feel like it's really powerful because it is making it okay and easier to talk about it. It becomes easier over time. And I guess maybe that's the other thing I'd say about trying to increase diversity on the board. Most of the companies that had three or four or five women on the board, so like the board that you mentioned, Tara, 50% women, that's insane. They said it was really hard at the beginning to get a woman board director, and then the second woman board director was a little bit easier, and then the third one was super easy, and then the fourth one was like a no-brainer. And so I think it requires effort in the beginning, but then it just becomes more natural. And if you think about, you bring a couple women on the board, well, now you have their networks. And if we want to select people from our network because it feels good and safe, then you've just totally expanded your network with people who are probably not in it. And so it becomes easier and easier. And I think it's the same thing when companies start to take on the issue of diversity. At first, it's like, this is like creepy and weird, and I'm not really sure if you're Hispanic or Latino or Latinx, like, how do I use this language? But like, once you start talking about it, it's just like any other language. And I love to use the analogy, again, so not a sports analogy, but of coding. So like, I don't code in MS-DOS, right? I had to learn new languages. And so, you know, now everyone I know is using SQL and Python. Well, I can't do that yet, but I'm going to update my language. And I feel like that's the same thing when it comes to learning about talking about diversity. It's like, this is relevant. This is business relevant. You need to update your language. You need to make this part of your conversation. And I think it takes work, but, it's super doable. Like, if I can learn SQL, then anyone can learn to talk about diversity.
Well, a lot of boards that we work with don't know coding either.
Oh, yeah. Well, but the analogy works really
but
well.
I do like the analogy.
Yeah. So if I'm in Silicon Valley, you know, they're like, oh, my gosh, yes. Now it makes sense. It's Python. Or they'll tell me usually, like, actually, Python's totally outdated.
So one last question is, what can we do if we suspect that we are experiencing unconscious bias against us, if somebody is holding some stereotype, or like if there are people in our community who want to apply to be a director or really in any part of their lives, what do you do if you suspect that that's an issue?
Okay, so I've heard lots of answers on this, and I think either of you could give a better answer than me, because I don't really know what works. But I say, like, one possibility is to, again, name the elephant in the room, or as I used to talk about in negotiations, like naming the dynamic.
Like, and Tara did with her directorship.
You got it. Yeah, exactly. Like, is it – so you think this person's not experienced or needs mentoring, like, you know, just to throw it out there, would you think the same thing if she were a man? Mm-hmm. And I don't know. So, like, I've heard, this is what I do, but I piss a lot of people off. So, like, I don't know if it's always the best. It's really hard, especially if you are a woman or a minority, to be that vocal person, because you feel, you know, you're already in a vulnerable position and you feel threatened. And, you know, I did this study that showed that women and minorities who support women and minorities are viewed as less competent. Hmm. So there's a risk, you know, in doing it. So I think this is one of the areas where we really can capitalize on white male allies. Not to say that, you know, white men are going to save women, but I think this is something that benefits everyone in the organization. It's not a benefit to women. It's a benefit to shareholders. And so if it benefits everyone, why isn't everyone doing it? I just saw the P&G video, Gillette, the best man.
Yeah.
Have you guys seen that?
Yeah. Yeah.
It's like, is this really the best man I could get? I think if, you know, if a man said, yeah, you think she's not experienced, but, you know, is there any possibility you think that because she's a woman? Like, it just has a very different tone than when a woman says it. And so I like to think of, you know, this is something we can all call out, and, you know, make it especially if you lay the groundwork to say that in this organization, we're going to hold each other accountable and we're going to allow the freedom to call each other out. So it's not like, wow, like, I can't believe you just called me out on that. It's like, this is what we do. We are, you know, we're playing devil's advocate and we're trying to make the best decisions. And, you know, maybe we're not doing that. And if it were some other issue, you would raise the possibility, right? But just if it's something around race and gender, people feel sheepish.
Yeah.
That's what I'm going to go with, is name the dynamic.
I like it. Good advice. Tara, you have any other final words of wisdom?
Oh boy, no! I'm out wisdomed by Dr. Johnson.
Well, you're the one doing these things, right? I'm sitting in my office studying them, but you're out there doing it. So,
it takes everyone, I think.
Right. I will make one plug for a Colorado company, but and this isn't even the amazing one that had 50% women on their board, but. Early in 2018, the CEO of a big public company that's based in Denver called DaVita, who does kidney dialysis and other health services, committed that he wants, he put in 3 women board members and he made this commitment. It was like this huge public announcement. It was at the Denver Post and it was everyone in the business community and everybody affiliated with the chamber, like everybody's all talking about it. And I think we need to, so that's fantastic, and I'm so happy about that. But the other thing we need to do, I think, if we're champions of diversity, is thank people for doing that or recognize them. And he got a lot of really good kudos. And again, because he's a white man making the support, it's like you said, Stephanie, and I'm not making this up because this is your research, it's like he's still seen as competent and great if he says that. So I guess my other thing is I just like acknowledging progress, right? Mm-hmm. That would be my other piece.
Yeah, that's cool. I'm going to have to look that up. I know DaVita is amazing, but I don't remember that big announcement.
I can, I'll send you a link about it.
Very cool.
Well, thank you both again. This was a really fun talk to have and interesting information as well. So I appreciate it. And I will look forward to talking with you both again, hopefully.
Yeah, thanks for having me on.
Yeah, thank you, Liz. This was really fun.
Of course. Thank you, Tara, for introducing us to Dr. Johnson.